First up today on Cairo FM, let me introduce you to Tim and Tom. You know comedy teams like Abbott and Costello, Martin and Lewis, Rowan and Martin, Burns and Schreiber, the Smothers Brothers, etc. All of those had one thing in common. Both members were white guys. Oh, there were some comedy teams that were both black guys, too. But Tim and Tom were America's first black and white comedy team. And probably their last as well. Tim is Tim Reed, who you know as Venus Flytrap from all his years on WKRP in Cincinnati, plus 6 years on Sister Sister, and all those years on Simon and Simon, and his great work on Frank's Place. Tom is Tom Dreesen, who is one of the country's top touring comedians, spent 14 years as Frank Sinatra's opening act, has done hundreds of appearances on television, and they write about their history as a comedy team together in a new book called Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White. Guys, welcome to Cairo FM.
Hi. Thank you, Paul.
It's a pleasure having you on the show here. Tim, I want to start with you a little bit because you grew up in an environment very, very different from what Tom grew up in, but at the same time, it was very similar. So tell me how you two guys met and became friends before you became comedy partners.
Well, I'm proud to say Tom was poorer than I was, so I don't mind going on.
His family bought me.
Beg your pardon?
Tim's family bought me.
That was also a first in America, now.
Yeah.
It was, looking at it now from in context of today's times, it was very unusual. But when you think back then, when I grew up in what was considered then Color Town in Norfolk, Virginia, it was quite common. I mean, it was difficult times. Country was still recovering from many years at the Depression. World War II was raging on when I was born. So it was very difficult times. And it took many years after that for our economy and the black community to even just begin to raise its head. So it was a struggle. But I was one of many, many who had to deal with it. I guess the irony of it is that our lives being so completely different in terms of region, terms of ethnic, terms of what was expected of us as children, for either of us to come together and become partners, or for that matter, have a career in show business, is sort of unique in itself. Neither one of us were headed towards stardom, I can tell you that much.
In fact, you were going to work for DuPont, right?
Yeah, I was very fortunate, having taken advantage of an education to get graduate from Norfolk State University and find myself employed by DuPont as its first black in its management training program. So that sort of took another twist from the projects right to the suburbs of Illinois, and it was a big cultural shock in itself from that.
All right, Tom, tell me your story and how you met Tim.
Well, you know, as Tim pointed out, he had moved into Chicago out of Norfolk State, graduated from Norfolk State College, and was recruited into Chicago by E.I. DuPont. That's where I was born and raised, on the south side of Chicago, a suburb called Harvey, Illinois. I had just gotten out of the service, and I was very active in a civic group called the JCs. And Tim, one of the first things he did when he moved out there was he joined the JCs. And we met, and JCs, as you know, are involved in civic projects all the time to better the community they live in, and thus giving them the members leadership training, serving on committees and learning how to chair committees and et cetera, et cetera. Well, one of the projects that Tim and I worked on, we wrote a drug education program teaching grade school children the ills of drug abuse with humor. It's a concept that we had that was very serious at that time, the problem as it is today among our youth. Well, in those days, remember, this is 1968 when Tim and I met, there was no drug education in colleges or in high schools, let alone at the elementary school level where Tim and I concentrated on. Well, the program became a huge success, and JCs use it as a model program in their publications in 50 states and in 22 foreign countries. And one day, a little eighth grade girl said to Tim and I, "You guys are so funny, you ought to become a comedy team." And, you know, the thought never occurred to us. And we start thinking about it, and then we start writing what we thought was material, and then we entered this wicked game of show business And the irony is that on this book tour that Tim and I are on now with our book, a woman came up to us. She's now nearing, she's in her 40s. She has three children, and she was the girl that gave us that idea, you know.
And she wanted some royalties.
if anytime somebody wants royalties from our career, they also have to take all the debts and the punishment that we endured.
They back off on that request.
So Tim, after doing these drug education programs, and this kid says you guys should go into comedy, did you decide, okay, we're going to do comedy about us because you're black, because I'm black and you're white, we're going to make it about being black and white? Did you say, oh, racial, we'll do that?
No, it wasn't quite that professional. That would give some sense that you had an understanding of what comedy was all about. Now, these are two guys who did, let's try something, and, well, how do we start? Well, let's write something funny. And we sat down in my table in my kitchen, and we just started putting out things that we thought would, observing things around us. And, of course, at that time in America, you got to realize this was only 5 years removed from the passage of the Civil Rights Act. So you couldn't do anything in America where race didn't at some point enter into it. I mean, there was still major conflict among black and white. So naturally, that would be part of it. So we chose to go at it a different way. Let's go at it in a way, confront it head on. Let's say what most people think and try to find a way to make both black and white audiences a bit relaxed about it. So it was a natural thing, but it wasn't the primary purpose of our coming together, or it wasn't everything we talked about. It just happens to be that anything we talked about was racial, just because of the mere fact a black and white man was on stage.
Talking with Tim and Tom, Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen. Their book is called Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White. They were America's first black and white comedy team and last. Tom, I laughed in the book when I read that both of you were told at various times that you weren't black enough.
Yeah. Well, you know, that happens all the time, I mean, in our business. That, you know, I mean, I've auditioned for roles where they said that I wasn't, you know, I'm Irish-Italian, you know, and lean more toward the Italian side. And I've gone up for roles, and they said that I wasn't ethnic, I wasn't Italian enough. And then a week later, I'd been turned down because I was too Italian, you know. It's all the nonsense you have to put up with. In our business, you know, you develop your craft, you work hard on your craft, and you get good at what you do, and then you have to learn to take rejection from that point on, because you're gonna get it at every level, you know, wherever you're at. Even Marlon Brando, as great as he was turned down as a role in The Godfather. He had to beg for a screen test to let him have it. Marlon Brando, I mean, so no matter where you go, you're gonna get rejected in show business. Just at a higher level. And Tim and Tom received rejection that no other comedy team in the history of show business ever had to endure, by virtue of the fact that one was black and one was white. It's just something about our society that really, while they pretend that they're above that and that's passé, it's not, and it's still not. It's just the nature of the beast, you know. And when Tim and I went out there, we received this from all ends. If we worked an all-black club, and if there was a black guy who hated white people, hated them with a passion, he wasn't mad at me. He was mad at Tim for being with me. And vice versa, if there was a redneck who hated black people with a passion, and he wasn't mad at Tim, he was mad at me for being with Tim. So it's that sort of thing that we had to endure.
You guys worked in clubs on the Chitlin circuit. What was that, Tim?
Well, that was a phrase that was created actually during the 30s and 40s when many of the entertainers from Bojangles to Count Basie could not work in white clubs. So there were this string of venues across black America in Color Town. And these clubs were quite popular and responsible for so many entertainers to practice their work. I mean, it was like the Negro Baseball League running parallel to the regular league. So those clubs stayed in existence till literally we caught the tail end of most of a few of those clubs that were still around. The 20 Grand Club in Detroit, Club Harlem in Atlantic City, Sugar Shack in Boston. These were wonderful clubs. And we happened to catch again the tail end of them. We worked them and worked all over the South and North and anywhere we could find work. We were just looking to work. It wasn't so much we were courageous. It was just that somebody would pay us to do what we were doing. We were there.
Do you remember your first paying gig? I mean, Tom, you were talking about how difficult it was to convince club owners to book you. Where was the first place you went and did your act on stage, and afterwards somebody gave you money?
It was called the Golden Horseshoe in Chicago Heights, Illinois. And the guy paid us, he had like three or four slots on the bill, and he was the headliner. His name was Eddie Warner. He played a Hammond organ. And
loudly.
He'd play night train so loud the roof would come off of it. But each act, he went and he booked us for four shows on a Friday, four shows on a Saturday, and two on a Sunday. And for this, we got $30. And I said to the guy, $30 a piece for 10 shows? He said, no, it's $30 for the act. It's $15 a piece.
Wow.
That's what we got. But we were thrilled because somebody paid us to perform. Yeah. And, of course, if you read the book, on the fourth time we ever performed, a guy put a lit cigarette out in Tim's face afterward and then tried to beat me half to death. All that's in the book, you know. So that was our first paying gig. But we were thrilled. I mean, we got paid to do stand-up comedy, to do our act, and that was a thrill.
You know? Did you walk off after the first gig, the first show of that weekend, and say, well, that's a dollar and a half?
No, we were really excited that we were being paid. It was our first paying gig. I mean, we went out and bought powder blue tuxedos so we could look good. And
that's always a good look.
Yeah, you know, always a good look. You know, a little cummerbund. You know, we were really. I'm wondering Ralph Lauren. Ralph Lauren didn't come by and just copy our look.
Yeah, those pictures are in the book, and when we look at them, we cringe. But we thought we were the sign of the times.
Did any of those club owners tell you what you could and couldn't do, or maybe after they had heard your first or second show of a weekend say, all right, none of that anymore?
No, they didn't. It was only, I mean, there were places back then you couldn't, of course, you couldn't curse in your act like kids do today. I mean, my goodness, there was no such thing as cursing in any of those clubs. They had, a morality clause of what you can't do. You know, there was no politics really to speak of. You couldn't talk about government officials and things like that with any consistency. You might be able, if you were clever enough, you could get away with it. But so it was pretty much character humor. We did some set pieces, monologues, things like that. Our act was people were so relieved that a riot didn't break out when we finished that they just was glad that we got through it. I mean, in most cases. So no, we didn't get a lot of that.
You remember, we worked the Playboy circuit, and when you worked the Playboy circuit, a lot of people would think that you could work blue, you know, work dirty, and you couldn't. I mean, you had to work clean and straight ahead. You know, you couldn't use the language that they use today. It was absurd, you know. And we had to be far more creative. And again, a lot of our material had nothing to do with race at all. It was, you know, we were doing observations about life. We used to do a lot of routines that had nothing to do with race. But the mere fact that on stage was a black guy and a white guy, it was a discourse. President Obama and as well as John McCain, to their credit, said we need more discourse among the races. I was laughing so many times when I kept hearing this. Here we are in the year 2009. You know, we need more discourse among the races. In 1969, 40 years ago, Tim Reed and I were that discourse.
Yeah,
we were on stage, two guys talking about life's observations, about our own personal feelings, etc., making it funny. But we were that discourse that the audience wouldn't have. And it's the irony is, it's 40 years have gone by, and we're still saying we should need more discourse among the races.
The book is called Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White. We'll come back and talk some more with Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen in just a moment. I'm Paul Harris, doing the Dave Ross Show today on News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM.
Dory Munson.
Media has, by and large, just become a mouthpiece for government. And I think it's shameful.
Noon to 3 on News Talk 97.3, Cairo FM.
Hi, this is Dave Ross. Here's a chance to enjoy your home this summer with an awning or sunscreen from Rainier's.
It's the Dave Ross Show on News Talk 97.3, Cairo FM. I'm Paul Harris, talking with Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen. You know Tim from his years on TV on Sister Sister and Simon and Frank's Place and his Venus Flytrap on WKRP in Cincinnati. And Tom Dreesen, well, if you've watched any late-night comedy show in the last couple of decades, you've seen Tom appearing. He even filled in as guest host when David Letterman was sick. It was Frank Sinatra's opening act for 14 years. But once they were together as a comedy team, known as Tim and Tom, and they write about their history as America's first interracial comedy team, and I guess last as well, in a new book called Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White. Tim, why hasn't there been a team like you guys in the last four decades?
I don't know. I guess the guys just don't have any cojones. I mean, I really don't understand it. I think also there is a feeling that it's not true, and everybody knows it's true, but we all try to pretend we are above race, you know, that it's passé now. We don't need to discuss that. We've had that issue with our book. They didn't know where to place our book. Is it an autobiographical book or is it a humor book? I mean, it rather than look at what it is, a slice of life and culture in America, I mean, I think what makes our story unique is not that two guys tried to go in show business and suffered and had a wonderful time and did, you know, and met a lot of obstacles. Is that the time in which we did it, we sort of are like, I don't know, we happen to go through history. We didn't, you know, what makes our story even, I think, more interesting is not what we did, it's what was being done while we tried to do what we did. I mean, we went through the sexual revolution, the drug revolution, the political transformation, you name it, it happened during that time. We just lost great leaders, Dr. King, Robert Kennedy, before that, I mean, Malcolm. All that was going on in America, there was a lot of conflict, a lot of anger, a lot of frustration. Here are two guys trying to make people laugh about race. Today, it's a lot easier. It's a lot, I don't know why. I think it's because there's sort of this illusion that we are above race, when in fact we're not.
Well, you got a lot of performers who still talk about race on stage, but none of them doing it as a team. And Tom, I find it ironic that here we have a president who is the son of a black man and a white woman, and in 2009, perhaps we would have a better environment for a black and white comedy team on stage. Could it be just the fact that comedy teams have waned?
Well, that's true. That's also true. There aren't as many comedy teams today as there were when Tim and I started out. But I agree with Tim. There's something that we could never put our finger on, and I still don't understand it, but it's the white liberal who was always more against us that held us back, I feel. And I think it's because, as Tim pointed out, they think they're above that. Oh, my God, this is passé. We don't even want to go there. You know, but when you say talk about race, if there's a black comic on stage talking about race, everybody accepts that. Oh, of course, you can talk about it all you want. You know, if there's a white comic and he's Jewish and he's talking about his Jewish heritage, or an Italian comic talking about his ethnic background, everybody accepts that. But when you have them both on stage at the same time, there's a tension in the air that, oh my God, where are they going with this? You know,
Also, even if you go back to Richard Pryor's days on stage where he imitated white people as part of his act, if you were a white comic and you imitated a black person on stage in a stereotypical voice, that wouldn't go well for you, would it?
Well, but you have to also, but people do it. I mean, comics do it all the time. And you know, I did an album in front of an all-black audience, but not once in the album did I ever try to pretend I was black.
Right.
Or even do an impression of my observations were of a white boy growing up in a black environment, they still do it all the time. It's just whether or not it's accepted. I don't know of a comedian, and maybe Tim can correct me on this, a white comedian that imitates black people that is a huge success.
Yeah,
with 100%
well,
of
I mean,
fact in that.
Also, you got to realize that there's nothing new about whites imitating blacks. Al Jolson, Georgia Jessel, I could go on and on and on about the whites who built careers in blackface.
Right.
I think one of the most tragic stories in the history of comedy, even W.C. Fields said this, is Burt Williams, and he was a black man who had to pretend to be a white man playing a black man. I mean, imagine how much Prozac he would have gone through. W.C. Fields, he said he was the funniest, saddest man he had ever met in his life. So being whites pretending to be black, Amos and Andy, I think, probably made more money in black comedy than any black or white man other than perhaps Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
So that's nothing new. I think what's missing is what Richard Pryor tried to do is a honest relationship of cultures. Richard had the unusual talent of being able to take us there through his characterizations of both black and whites without offending us. In other words, he took us into the story. So we were there with him, and we could in strange ways empathize even with the white guy. In some of his routines, when a white guy walked into a black club and the black guy tried to sell him a radio, I mean, it's one of the funniest things stories ever been told. But I think that today's comics are a bit bitter. I mean, comedy today is angry. It's in your face. It's vindictive. And so when they do race, it's a whole different point of view, as we see when some of them go too far. So I think it's up to the comic. However, race has been taken away from the comic. It's now the domain of political pundits who hide behind microphones in nice, well, air-conditioned, enclosed, security, protected studios. They don't go out in front of the people. You know, they wouldn't go in a little small club and say some of the things or take up the position that they take, because they know they would have to face the wrath of the public. We did. And I think that's the fear when I say they have no cojones. Even today, if a black and white man walked on a stage in a club, the first thought the audience is going to have is, I wonder what they're going to do racially. I mean, it's a natural part of our DNA. We can't get around it. So they either have to take it on or hide behind it, you know, or not mention it at all.
Guys, I've got to get to a break here, but if you could hold on, I'd love to do another segment with you, talk more about this and about your solo career since you broke up, okay?
Okay.
I appreciate that. Tim Reed and Tom Dreis, and the book is called Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White. I'm Paul Harris, doing the Dave Ross Show on News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM. It's 9:37 at News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM. Paul Harris filling in for Dave Ross while he's on vacation this week. In a little while, I'll introduce you to a guy who went to law school with Sonia Sotomayor, who this morning became President Obama's official nominee to become an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. And just after 10 o'clock, we expect a ruling from California's Supreme Court on whether they're going to overturn Prop 8, the gay marriage ban there. We'll talk with some of the gay rights activists here in the Seattle area who are planning a rally for this afternoon. All of that ahead this morning here on News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM. Right now I'm talking with Tim Reed and Tom Dreisen. Tom is one of the country's top touring comedians, who was the opening act for Frank Sinatra for 14 years and has done hundreds of appearances on television, filled in for David Letterman when he was sick. Tim Reed, you know from his years on TV shows like Simon and Simon and Frank's Place and Sister, Sister. He was also Venus Flytrap on WKRP in Cincinnati. But I'm sure he remembers most fondly the high point of his career resume, 2 months as a stand-up comedian at a topless place in Washington, D.C. What was that gig about, Tim?
It was about fun. that gig was a gig that I needed to actually survive and continue to be able to live in California. I wasn't making any money and wasn't acting, couldn't get arrested, and working at the Comedy Store back in the days when they weren't even paying. It was before Tom and his group got together and forced them to pay. But I was there, and a guy saw myself, and I think that night Jay Leno, and he came to and a bunch of other comics, and he chose myself and Jay Leno to come work his club. He had one in Vegas and one in Washington. Well, the one in Vegas was closed down. We later found out it was closed down by the government for some problems of some kind. And so Jay said, I'm not going to Washington to work in the topless space, man. I can't afford that for my career. And I'm going, I cannot afford not to go. So I went and ended up staying there. I did two turns there. One I did because I needed the money, and I was there 8 weeks, and it literally changed my career. I working before interesting audiences, lunch. I did a lunch show, and then I did two shows a night. And on weekends, I did three shows in this topless place, and it turned out to be a wonderful experience, practicing and being able to work your material. And I went back, and things began to happen. My self-confidence was up, and I began to work as an actor. And then, of course, after I got famous with WKRP in Cincinnati, I got a call from these same people saying, you're coming to work for us. I said, no, you can't afford me. He said, you don't understand. You're coming to work for me. So I wanted to end up in cement. I went back and worked there for about 6 weeks and had a wonderful relationship with the people who control that club.
How? I don't go to strip clubs, so I don't know this, but I don't think that they have anything except naked women on stage these days. What is it like being a guy fully dressed getting up there in between the naked breasts?
Oh, no, you have it wrong. Tim had to work topless.
Oh, he didn't understand, did he? No, no. No, it was you know, the guys had to get to catch their breath and you know, regain their strength. So I was just really the believe it or not, the warm up act, you know.
Uh-huh.
when we say topless, the young ladies used to dance on the tables and for the guys, and they had the big thing was a lunch crowd. All the people from the Pentagon and all the other government offices would come in there. The place was packed for lunch. The weekends they were pretty strong. During the week at nights, it was not that crowded. And matter of fact, one of the owners was at that time being investigated by the Senate Subcommittee hearing for organized crime. So,
uh-huh. Nice.
To say the least, it was an interesting experience.
Tom, speaking of opening acts, I mentioned that you did 14 years on the road with Frank Sinatra, but even including Frank and your one-time partner, Tim Reed, did you ever work with anybody more talented than Sammy Davis Jr.?
No, I toured with Sammy for 3 years, you know, and Frank for 14. And I've also toured with Smokey Robinson and Gladys Knight and the Pips and Natalie Cole. And I've been fortunate in my career to tour with some of the nation's top singing artists. But Sammy was a parade. You know, there wasn't anything Sammy couldn't do on stage. He could sing. Frank Sinatra told me one time, he said, I never heard Sammy hit a bad note. Frank would hit a clinker once in a while, but Sammy never hit a bad note. He could sing as good as anybody out there. He could dance better than anybody out there. He could do comedy as good as any comedian I knew. He could do impressions as good, if not better, than all the impressionists. He could play piano. He could play the drums. He could play the trumpet. There was nothing he couldn't do on a stage. He was, for me, the years I toured with him, to sit in the wings and watch him every night, it was like going to school. He was a grandmaster of the stage, of live performing. You know.
And he would stand in the wings and watch you, right?
Yeah, he and Frank, too. They both gave me a lot of advice in counsel, you know. And, you know, Sammy loved comedians. And Frank Sinatra thought that stand-up comedy was the hardest art form. He expressed that many times. He said the stand-up comedian has the toughest job in show business, you know.
Tim, in the book, Tim and Tom, in American Comedy in Black and White, there's a lot of stuff about race, obviously, since you were the first black and white comedy team. I want to ask you a question about WKRP that I was always curious about. The very first time we see you as Venus, you are dressed as, I guess we have to say, the stereotypical black pimp.
Yeah.
I mean, here you are, hired as the nighttime disc jockey, and you show up there. With your sensitivity to racial issues, especially having worked all those clubs with Tom, did you ever go to Hugh Wilson, the creator of WKRP, and say, I don't want to be that kind of black guy on this show?
Well, that's what I said when I first went and read for the part. And ironically, of all the guys out there waiting, when I sat down, I turned it down, in a sense. They asked me what I thought, and I said, I don't think I want to be known as Venus Flytrap when I'm 60 years old. Well, here I am. And Hugh Wilson, the creator and producer, and he said, why? And I explained to him why. And he said, you're right. He says, but I don't know. This is a pilot. We're trying to get this thing on the air. He said, but I like that you understand that because I want to explore this guy. And I told him, I said, most disc jockeys I know black are dual people. I mean, whoever that you hear when you hear these jockeys and you see them in live, very rarely do they match their appearance. And he said, okay, let's work on that. So he allowed me, I knew going in that I was going to have an opportunity to explore that character. So it came off. It ended up being a whole different way than the network wanted it and everybody expected it to be.
And at the end of the first season, you did a great episode called Who is Gordon Sims, in which we found out that Venus was really an AWOL Vietnam vet. Did you push for that storyline?
No, that was actually Hugh. We had all been promised our episode, our single episode, and I was the only one in the group who had not been given one. The network really didn't think that I was going to be coming back because I wasn't, quote, black enough. They wanted it to be really extreme. And Hugh had written this and said to me, I got the thing that I think will help your character and launch you in the way that we want to go with it. And they fought him on it until finally, because of finance, they didn't think the show was coming back. So they said, look, no, the show's not coming. Let him do what he wants to do. And we did the show, and it turned out to be one of the shows that helped turn the series around, and our ratings went up, and it was the first show in television history to tell the story about Vietnam, to explore the story of Vietnam. This was way before Lou Grant, way before any of them, and it was one that got a lot of attention.
We've just touched on the careers of Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen. You should really read this book, not only to hear the history of their days as America's first and last black and white comedy team, but also all the things that they have done since then. Pretty remarkable careers, guys. Congratulations, and thanks for joining me on the show today.
Paul, if people want to get the book, they can go to Barnes & Noble or Borders, but they also go to Amazon or to our website, timandtomcomedy.com.
There you go.
TimandTomComedy.com.
The book is called Tim and Tom in American Comedy in Black and White. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Dave Ross Show on News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM.